Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Are you all well? So, I was in my apartment and I was picking what to wear. And I thought, I'm Xhosa. In my culture, when you are mourning, we are zila. You wear black when you are mourning. And I feel as a country, we should be mourning the stats we have of GBV, the murder of children and women. And I feel like the people at the very top do not believe there is a problem. So I thought, let me wear all black because we have a problem and I think we should be mourning as a country. But it's a pleasure to be here. And there are four incredibly strong and incredible women with incredible, amazing opinions. But I feel like this conversation cannot be had without men.
Amen.
And I feel like this conversation needs to have men involved. As allies, as support, because a lot of the issues are because of us, and systematically as well, the system just feels like it keeps on breeding men who keep on hurting women and children. So this room should have more men than women, but it does not. And we will keep on striving to get to the point where we need to be. The topic of today is, what will it take to keep women safe in South Africa? My panelists are Eleanor Spies, member of National Assembly, DA's deputy spokesperson for women, youth, and persons with disabilities. Pat Lekker, member of the Western Cape Provincial Legislature. We have Rachel Colisi, humanitarian, businesswoman, and mother of four. Ronelle E. Stevens, program director with Mosaic. So I thought when we were having a briefing about this particular conversation, I said to them, we cannot start the conversation without asking each panelist, what do you define as safety? And what does safety in society look like? I'll start with you.
Thank you very much, and good evening to all of you. I think when we define safety, we cannot look at the word in its in isolation. One needs to look at, you know, human security, but also human rights. You have to look at individual safety as well as collective safety. And so for me, safety is the freedom of you being able to pursue your aspirations, live your life without undue harm, without undue damage and hurt, and also to have the freedom of safety socially, economically, and psychologically. And it must be done looking at both sides, the human and personal and the collective.
Anything else to add on what does the word safety mean?
Yeah, I actually wanted to say yes and, which is a new value add for us. When we think about safety at Mosaic, firstly we think about safety in relationships, in homes and in communities, because sometimes it gets to like the individual and you forget about the collective. And for us it really is thinking about a place or a space or dreaming about a space that is actually free from violence and we actually are able to trust that our systems will work and we are able to actively use the systems that are being put in place and the laws that are put in place. I think that it's very important that while it's the human rights, that's the fundamental kind of thing that holds us together, it's also important to understand that structures had been created and we need to find ways to dismantle those structures in order for us to actually experience true safety.
Anything else that Ed?
I tend to agree with the two speakers. For me, a safe net is an environment where you are able to walk in the corridors of your workplace without anybody wanting to see whether you've got a cleavage or not. And it starts at the workplace where you would be expected to show your body. And in the communities, there's a very scary situation where you can't even send your children to go and play in the park because you have a fear. So for me, it should be a situation where you do not have fear of going anywhere or even in the household of being afraid to leave your children with your brother or with your husband. And in many times, you find that people actually don't even feel safe in their own homes. And it therefore wants one to define exactly as to what is a safe space. A safe space would be where you feel comfortable, you feel safe, you're secured, and you know nobody will harm you in any way. But the problem is we are in a society where human rights are not being valued, and it starts there. If we don't value human rights, we tend to act very abrupt, we act reckless and do many things. And as a result, people, most of the time victims of GBV, would know who have had them. And it's sometimes people who are supposed to have been protecting them. So a safe space is difficult to define if you know there are these odds that you ought to look after when you are in any environment, be it in the society, be it at workplace, in church, or anywhere for that matter. So a safe space then would be something that needs to be defined properly, where you feel safe, where you know that there is no chances of you being harmed, be it physically or emotionally. So that should be a safe space.
Rachel, anything you want to add?
I just feel freshened out.
No. You don't have to add anything. Like, what we're trying to do is make sure this is a conversation. It's not just, I won't be just asking questions to everyone. Mm-hmm. If anyone has anything to say, to jump in, you can jump in. Not everyone has to have this conversation. I spoke about...
Siv, I'm going to... Yeah? Just to add. I was kind of just reflecting, and of course, all the points I think that have been brought forward are absolutely important and valid. Just thinking very practically, like in my household and with children, right, and raising kids, and especially like where they are at ages now, I feel like very practically, like safety at home is just that they can express themselves in like whatever way and form that comes in. So if they're mad, if they're sad, if they're joyful, if they feel safe, they can express all those feelings comfortably. And I think that just, that should kind of filter through to adulthood as well.
So we spoke about kids in households. How are we living in a country that's breeding such violent men? And how can we fix that? I know that's a difficult question to go in. It's not even on here, but you mentioned, I know your kids, I know people in your household, and I one day want to be a father, and I want to learn, how do I make sure I don't breed monsters?
I think...
Anyone can jump in. It doesn't... Okay. It's not one for one. Don't worry. Anyone can just jump in.
At the age of 54, I have a 31-year-old son and a 15-year-old, just turned 15 today, and an 18-year-old. And
all boys?
No. My girl is 18.
Okay.
And the boys, 31 and 15. And we have consistent conversations about how you treat your partner, how you treat other women, my boys, and my girl, as to what is it that you will accept and tolerate and whatnot. And I believe we men and boys should be our allies. We should constantly working on developing positive masculinity and empowering our young men and old to understand themselves emotionally and work on that emotional intelligence, emotional vulnerability. We cannot do it without them, as you rightfully said. This room should have been full of more men than women. And I think in that way is, let's work on the fathers. Let's work on the young men. Let's work on our boys in our homes. Let's work with our colleagues at our workplaces. Let the men also be the same and say, not in my name.
I joined Mosaic about 3 years ago, and I would have probably been like anyone else sitting in the back and not known as like a GBV specialist because of the work that I do. And I remember once going into one of our projects where we had started a Building Stronger Families program. And it's a program where both the parents, whether they are in a relationship or they're co-parenting a child, they are being coached through learning, unlearning, relearning how to actually be a positive parent. So not a positive dad and a positive mother, a positive parent, but also a positive person in a couple. Because I think what often happens is that if we don't relate well to one another, it does trickle down to our children because they're exposed to it fundamentally. But the point I was going to make about my experience coming in was that I had experienced violence in my home, and I had seen what that workshop for 10 weeks, for example, had done to those who had participated. And for me, I was just thinking from a very practical space, because it's good to talk about, like, it would be so great if we could learn about these things, if we can acknowledge these things, if we could be exposed to different parenting style, positive parenting, you know, masculinity, positive masculinity, all of these things. But it's very difficult to practically see it happen. And whilst it's not like, you know, a world-renowned educational policy workshop that we did, I think what fundamentally was the difference for me was that I came into the room, I saw what the facilitators did, I could see how the changes came, and every week for the 10 weeks, men and women would come to these workshops, rain or sunshine, and they will be participating fully, they'll go home and they'll do the activities. And what we could see is fundamentally, if people are given the space, and not just the assumption that you leave their laws or there are ways to do better and just expect people to do and be better, but actually to give the actual tools to enhance. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's about taking it from just, you know, a wishful thought or a thing that we want to have, but rather to like a practical space where we can say, this is actually how you could run the workshops. This is who can attend and who should attend. And it wasn't just people who used the views, because actually we didn't know. But really the point was that people had left with practical skills and tools that they can apply, and we could see the shifts and the changes. And so for me, it's a bit more of not just doing the talk, but actually doing like the work of committing yourself to workshops like this and programs like this, and also not seeing it as a issue for people who live in a township, because that's not where violence is located only. Mm. And I think it's important that we also carry that through the conversation. Mm. Practical skills. And because I had experienced violence at home, I think it was also one of those kind of like moments where my heart shifted, where I could see that if there were spaces like this for people like my dad, for example, like our history, my experience would have been so much different.
Mm. Yeah.
Charity begins at home. Mm. True. And if we start at home, teaching our children to be kind to one another, that will actually double up to the entire society that our children are reared in. But in my observations, I've seen many efforts being made for a girl child. Mm-hmm. And I think what becomes important is that at some point we need to hold a boy child by the hand and teach them how to be kind and how to behave. Because when they become men, they will become the very same persons that they have been
exposed to,
brought up in their family life with parents fighting with one another. And if there could be more efforts put on rearing a boy child, I know that a child is raised not only by their parents, but by the society. So if we start rearing those boy child in a particular direction, then things will turn out differently. It's not going to take a few months or a few years. It's going to take a decade, but it needs somebody to put action, and that action must be speedily activated so that the boy child out there becomes a better person tomorrow. I don't think there's any boy child who wants to practice bullying at school, but they bully others because at home they are not happy with something else. So if we start at home, then we'll be able to produce better men tomorrow, and there'll be less violence against women. I'm not saying there's only violence against women. There are women who are violent towards their partners, but the fact is we need to rear our child in a better way, so that they become better persons tomorrow.
I listened to a podcast the other day that said we spend too much time concentrating on genetic fathers instead of the father broad figure. And growing up, I would have been nothing without the men in my life, the next door neighbor, or the guy around the corner, or my grandfather. Mm-hmm. Genetics, a lot of the times, I wasn't even related to them. Mm-hmm. But suddenly now, we're so fixated on who's genetically the father. So you feel like a lot of these kids don't have influences, as the people online.
Yeah.
I would much rather hit the next door neighbor, who's this great man, who I learned from as a kid, compared to the kids who are online consuming information from people who they don't even get to meet in person. Mm-hmm. We've got no responsibility towards them. Mm-hmm. So this particular podcast was talking about how we need to move away from just celebrating genetic fathers. Mm-hmm. And how important that these gigantic father figures are to the world.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that as well, and also agree with all the points, you know, that the boy child is so important. But I'm also exhausted, right, from having the same conversations over and over and over again, mm-hmm. and listening to, like, you know, men need to step up. We need to focus on the boy child to change generations that come up. And parents, I mean, ultimately what's been spoken about here, the majority of women are raising the boys. The dads are non-existent. And yes, there are 100%. There are and should be father figures in the kids' homes and environments. But the reality is men are just not taking enough responsibility for themselves. And men are not saying, as adults, and like, forget about being a child. And of course, we can and we should implement as many programs for the boy child as much as possible. But men know, and the conversation, I believe, has been had enough for every man, especially in South Africa, to know that there is a serious problem. And the fact that men are still kind of considering gender-based violence being I'm abusing her, and if I'm not doing that, I'm good, that everything that happens before that is not a problem or not being spoken about. So men are essentially saying, if I'm not beating up a woman, I'm good. I haven't done anything wrong. Mm. Instead of actually consulting and dealing with the situations that they are having on their boys' nights and on their boys' trips, and like, I'm doing this, I'm having these conversations, I'm hearing my friends speaking about this. Instead of dealing with those conversations at that level already, they're saying, I'm good, I'm not a part of gender-based violence, I'm not a part of the problem. Yeah. But you 100% are. And I think that until men as adults start saying, like, there is a problem, what internally, like emotionally, like the emotional intelligence it takes to kind of do a reflection and say, like, as me as a man, am I where I should be, and what could I be doing to be better, to make life easier? And I think something as simple as respecting the women that are having to lead homes because they are not here is a very simple way to show respect and to show support in the struggle for women.
The conversation of what have I done to add to the problem is a lot more of a difficult conversation than the conversation of going, I've never raped, I've never beat a woman. Mm-hmm. But the difficulty of the conversation is going, what am I saying in my WhatsApp groups? Mm-hmm. And I don't think, as much as we think adults are responsible, I don't think men realize the part we play in the small little fights.
Absolutely.
And I say we, because I am a we. The small little things that add up to the big issue. Mm-hmm. I don't think the average man knows the part that they play in those particular things.
Well, and the average man doesn't even know what gender-based violence is. Mm-hmm. The average man thinks that gender-based violence is beating a woman, raping a woman, mm-hmm. where there's several other types of gender-based violence that are not being addressed or spoken about.
Okay, let's go right to the very beginning. Let's talk about the root causes of why South Africa has such a high gender-based violence problem.
It's exactly that. It's like the privilege of the hierarchical structures that society actually has. Mm-hmm. Some people call it patriarchy, which actually is what it is. But if you want to go deeper, it's like, well, if society had been structured in such a way that men are at the top, at the helm, mm-hmm. women are somewhere at the bottom with mm-hmm. children, persons with living with disabilities, et cetera, or vulnerable people, that kind of like imbalance brings about a power imbalance, and of course power and control, and then we could go into like deeper things. And I particularly want to point to a fact that oftentimes the conversation is positioned to be an economic conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And because it becomes an economic conversation, it means that it's only, this is the kind of exclusion stuff that we start doing, it's only people in the township, black people, you know, black men persecuting, you know, black woman experiencing. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we make, and this often happens when we start talking about things like unemployment as a root cause, mm-hmm. when in actual fact, the root cause is the societal structure. Yeah. And for us, we at Mosaic, we often talk about the stresses. So the root causes are almost exacerbated by the stresses, and the stresses is the use of substances, and then like mental health and all of these other things are stresses rather than actual root causes. But if we deal with like the root cause, which is this power and control and the imbalance that it brings, that may be the way that we shift. But I also want to say that like when we think about the root cause and we think about the stresses, we understand that like preventative work is long-term work, and that's what you're saying, Rachel, is that it's the long-term stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So you can find yourself being like, oh, it's okay because I'm not doing A, B, C, D, mm-hmm. but you're not thinking about like how, even in the way that you like dress, the way that you like make jokes, the way that you think, like chat to your friends about certain things, how that's making like that long-term work so inaccessible and so difficult. And I think that for us, again, at Mosaic, it's thinking about how do we do that long-term work while also recognizing that the violence is happening now and we have to respond and we have to create the structures to respond adequately.
So what I wanted to say there, sorry, is can our woman wait any longer for things to change? I don't, like, we talk about systematic issues, but can South African women wait any longer with an average of 80 murders a day and 20 of those a woman? Can our woman wait any longer?
No, not at all.
Like, and not at all.
We've waited too much.
They cannot.
We've waited for far too long.
So, police. Let's talk about police. Let's talk about police and the Jews. Let's talk about police. Now I know
I'm gonna be frank there.
I'm coming to you. But like, let's talk about policing. Let's talk about policing. Today I drove through Nyanga. During the day, it's busy. At night, the rape, the murders. There was a murder of the lady just lying on the side of the street, in the middle of the street at night. How can we get our police to do more, to improve? What can be done?
Proper training.
So first of all,
I'm coming. Proper training.
They need to be trained properly, because some of them, they will actually expose a woman to a secondary victimization. Women go there to lodge a complaint. Some make fun of her. Before you are sent to a victim support room, you get to express yourself to a man. Or you get to express yourself to a female who thinks what you are reporting is neither here nor there. It's something that was supposed to have happened. So if we start by training the members of the SAPS properly and sensitizing them on how to deal with cases of GBV, that will be a plus one.
So okay. I want to go further with the training. This training must be mandatory. It must be mandatory sensitivity training. Really, it must be part of your course. Yeah. Because at any given time, when there is a case reported, you don't know who's going to be in charge. So every person in the force needs to have that as mandatory training. But also, judges in how they deal with victims and survivors. I believe we should have GBV courts. Ooh, I mean, if you look at how if you look at the number of convictions, rape convictions, it's very low. Why is that happening? Why is there not a focus on that?
Is rape not difficult to prove? Because it's between you and her. Proving it can't be that easy.
No, but
how do you prove that it wasn't consensual?
But if
so that, I know, sorry, the question I had, that had to be asked, because a lot of the times, this is why a lot of men get away with it a lot of the times, because a lot of the times it's difficult to prove, was it consensual, was it not consensual?
But that is where it comes in, that prior to the person even going to the local police station, that he, that she or he gets the proper support. Yeah. And that's where we come in, where we work with people such as the Ronells, such as your GBV ambassadors, people who support and literally walk the talk with that person to the local SEPs. Because it's scary to, for any person to just rawly go in there. And so if we could work on saying that we need to make sure that in every town and city and rural community, we have gender-based violence ambassadors that are trained to, when it hits, they will be there. There will be a team, and there must be specific, there must be units within police station that deals with that particular victim or survivor in there before they could even go and, you know, write down that statement and everything, to prepare themselves psychologically and mentally for what is to happen. Because that's where it all sometimes just falls away and they decide, we are not going further with this, we were drawing this, because it's all too much. We all are not strong enough to deal with this. I can, Rachel can, but the next person cannot. And so the work beforehand needs to be done before she puts her foot, he or she puts their foot into that police station to go and actually report the case.
I'd actually just like to add as well, like, I've had many conversations with many police along the way, and especially in my work in the last 5 years. And I actually just want to address this blanket statement of, like, all police are terrible and useless, because they're not. It's the same as, like, all men are trash. They're not. There's actually some that are doing a good job and are doing the best they possibly can. And in the conversations that I've had with the police, and I also think it's, unfortunately, we are having to kind of highlight the people that are not just talking about, you know, doing good things and changing the narrative and changing the reality for women, but are actually actioning and doing things that are going to have an impact on gender-based violence and women's experience of it in South Africa. But I think from the police's perspective and in the conversations I've been having, it is extremely demotivating when you are working, firstly, for some of the salaries that you're working for in this country. Secondly, you go out, you do a phenomenal job, you bring perpetrators in, and hours later, that same person is out on the street again. Do you hold police accountable for that? No. There's a justice system, there's a system that happens above that that needs to actually be addressed. I think gender-based violence courts are absolutely a great solution to the problem in our country. I think that the cases are so backed up, and that's why we're having perpetrators re-perpetrating. Because English.
Don't worry, it's not your language. It's not your language. This language. This English thing is not easy.
I don't have an excuse, though.
For me, it's not easy.
You're re-offending.
And what I think, you know, with your question is to consent. There has been reforms. Back in the days, a definition of rape was an insertion of an object into a vagina. And there was a reform to an extent that a definition was then changed to say it's an insertion of an object in an opening. So it could be any opening that is defined as rape. But there's one aspect that have not been dealt with as far as consent is concerned. Because in court you would be asked, did you say no? And in many instances, a woman would be saying, I was shocked, I cried, and I was in fear. Obviously, that if courts would put a reasonable man's test, then that effect of giving consent vis-a-vis, I cried, I was in shock, I kept on shaking my head, because shaking your head does not necessarily mean no. So we need to drill down in some of the cases that comes to court and point out as to what were the problems. So this thing of consent is one of the major problems that warrants the courts to release the perpetrators. And I think at some point, you know, my cousin's sister was gang raped in 1998. And whenever, because that time I was staying on campus, I would go home over weekends. and I would notice this group of boys and identify them. Little did I knew that they were always standing there to intimidate my sister, my cousin's sister, not to continue with the court case. And on the last day, the case was thrown out of court. She never at any stage said, those boys are there to intimidate me. Or having somebody from court, because the matter was brought in book by 9 and they went to lunch, they were called in again, she's not at court. Those boys have been kept for more than 3 years in custody. And she was not at court, the matter was thrown out of court. And she never, up until we got to hear that this is not a matter to be proceeded for unless we bring in new evidence. And at the same time, she was gang raped. Whenever she becomes conscious, they knock her with the back of the gun, and she becomes unconscious. So the certain reforms that needs to be attended to, including as to at what stage do you throw a matter out of court?
So I was at the march for Uyanene on Ruland Street in front of Parliament, and I was standing on the tree, and I remember Cyril Ramaphosa coming and promising everything and anything. If we're sitting here and having these conversations and the number one of the country has made so many promises and not delivered, how can we hold him, the people up there, accountable?
So South Africa has obviously a lot of progressive laws, but we are weak in enforcement. And that is something that I think from the portfolio that I serve in, which is women, youth, and persons with disabilities. The portfolio is a monitoring and evaluation portfolio. It's not a service delivery, which means our job is to make sure that each and every ministry or department in the government is in fact implementing projects and initiatives that addresses not only GBV, but youth development, persons with disabilities. And I feel, and this is my personal view,
that
portfolio is all, it's not being taken serious in the manner it should be. It is an extremely important portfolio. Within the 7th Parliament, I think we are very intentional as committee members now to say we are not going to be seen as just the portfolio in the presidency. We are going to make sure that every department will come and they will come and sit with us and account to us. And we want to know if you don't have a particular program but there's money budgeted for it, why is it not happening? So they must account. And we've been doing it in the few first months. I mean, there's a gender-based violence council that is supposed to be up and running. We, as a committee, decided this is it's been approved by Parliament. It must happen. But there was no plan. It was something that was decided on and agreed on. But there was never thinking about how it's going to work. Civil society, what do we need? There is, at this very moment, not a budget for that. And we, as a committee, said we'd rather look at a committee bill where we sit and we thresh this out. We take it back to Parliament and say, this is how we're going to do this.
Have they failed our women?
I feel by approving something in the 6th Parliament and in the 7th Parliament, not having it activated and operated, we are, in a way, failing our women. Because that council could, in fact, be adding to what is already happening out there, what the Ronells are doing, you know, what the Sarki Bartman's centres are doing, if we get our story right. So that's why I'm saying it's good to have progressive laws, but can we enforce it? Yeah. And Rachel was saying, we talk and talk. We have talks. I agreed to come to the CNOs when he said it's solution-driven. Because when I leave here, I can go to my committee and I can say to them, guys, this is what is needed. This is what needs to happen. I'm no more prepared to sit in rooms where we just talk, where we take resolutions but we do not hold implement. Ourselves accountable and those who are responsible accountable. And if people are not doing their work, and if they are not using the budgets as allocated, let's act now. Let's not wait till the next budget needs to be approved and we then want to highlight all these things. So the resources are there, I believe. And yes, maybe it might not be there, but I think we can work with what we have if we are intentional about what we want to achieve here. And a gender-based violence council that has been approved over a year ago, still not operating. We are failing our women.
So each of you, please, if you had the power and the money and the resources, I need you to tell me one thing you would change in the system right now, each of you. You start.
I'll start, because it actually flows a little bit on your point now and about, like, you know, Cyril coming to talk. He said actually he was going to be back an hour later and he didn't come back. But I think ultimately the responsibility is not, I think, up to one man, and I think also he answers to a lot of people, right? So it's complex. I do think, however, it would be really amazing to see the government working a lot closer with the nonprofit sector. So if I had money and all the power and influence in the world, that's what I would hope would happen. I have spent time with organizations from all different levels, sectors, spaces, and the amount of red tape that nonprofits that are doing phenomenal work in this country have to jump through and get around and cut in order to get their work done, which is essentially the government's job, is insane. And so I think if there were a better link between government and the nonprofit sector, and not just in gender-based violence, but this is obviously the conversation we're having tonight, but if there was a better link between the two, I think there is so much more that could be happening. Mm-hmm. But there is no collaboration, and I've heard about this committee, and I've been in very interesting rooms with very interesting people with budgets that were insane, but they want to give it to, like, production companies, they want to do adverts, they want to sponsor this one. I'm like, none of that is dealing with gender-based violence in our country. I'm like, so I'm very passionate about this, and I just feel very strongly it would be amazing if government would put more in place to have more of an intention to really work together with the nonprofit sector to address this issue. I think we would go a lot further, a lot faster.
Yeah. Including communities.
I was about to say, I think that there's two parts for me about what I'm hearing, Rachel, and also just what we're experiencing. I think firstly is to acknowledge what NGOs and regular CBOs who are unregistered, what they are doing. The aunt that's making food, the people who wake up at 4 o'clock, that's unpaid, walking children to school. Yeah. You know, everyone has their part that they play, but it's not acknowledged. So that's the first part. Mm. I would say that if I had money, I'll of course put money into our organization.
Welcome to South Africa, everyone.
No, but like, the real issue really is that, you know, you referred to the good laws that we have. Mm-hmm. And the issue around implementation is that we hadn't considered how the finance needs to be unlocked to bring resources to ensure that these good laws actually are implemented. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we spend a lot of our time having to train people who should actually know what their job is, but to train them on what their job should be and how it should look at the local level. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, like, locally, to try and unlock the funding to trickle all the way down to ensure that people are able to have the resources, because if you're talking about, I don't know why I'm thinking about Mitchell's Plain so hard today, but if you're thinking about a place like Mitchell's Plain where there's gang violence, and if you call in distress for a GBV event, there's only one vehicle. Like, you know, and then the result will be that you don't trust SAPs. That's the narrative that you build. And so it is having to invest in these local kind of resources to unlock that law that's at the national level. But I would also say, and I would remiss if I don't say this, but the judicial system and structure and the police, SAPS, is crucially important as a functionary to also protect women and children. And so when we are talking about, you know, they are not doing what they're doing, you know, and there's a lot of like leading narrative around how they're not doing their job, mm-hmm. but they're also not the be-all and the end-all. And I think it's mm-hmm. also about thinking about how do we play a role in effecting what needs to happen in communities, and also ensuring as an organization, we do a lot of training with SAPS and we do a lot of training with magistrates and ordinary people, community influencers, magistrates, social workers, whoever is supposed to be like responsible as an individual, as a citizen of this country, to see the things that's wrong, to also know that you have the right to be able to go and unlock the wrong and say to the station commander, I've seen something happen in your station. This is not right. I need you to do something about it. If they're not doing something about it, there are other structures and institutions that are established. Mm-hmm. We should be able to use these establishments or institutions to our advantage as well. But that also relies on us knowing that they exist and knowing that we are able to like access as a regular, regular person. You do not need to be a GBV practitioner to be able to do that work. You can see the wrong and also pledge and say something about the wrong.
But what I want to say, and I'm probably not going to be popular with my colleagues who's listening to the podcast,
is editor, that
parliamentarians, I come from a background of where I used to be a mayor, so I was very on the ground. So I'm still getting used to parliament because it's too many hours of meetings. So I want our committees to be out there more. I want us to say, okay, we'll spend 1 hour in a meeting to just discuss. The next 1 or 2 hours, we are visiting Ronell's place. We are visiting Mosaic. We are, you know, we are visiting, and we actually see Ronell engage with us. And based on what we experience, we take that. You know, we have sessions and engagements with Department of Basic Education, health, and all of that. And I one day just asked, but why are we having this meeting amongst ourselves? Mm. Why do we not have anyone from civil society in the meeting? Because what I do when I'm in those meetings, I talk to people on civil society on my phone. I'm like, these people are saying this here. Is this happening?
About it?
No, it's not. Then I say, oh, I'm just speaking to this person at this very moment. They say that there are no business hubs at TVET colleges. you know? And that's sometimes people, not sometimes, I think people like us are needed. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think parliamentarians should be doing. Mm-hmm. Get out of your offices, chambers, committees, more.
Yeah.
And if it's oversight, can it be an oversight that is actually productive? Mm-hmm. Plan it properly so that when you engage with NPOs, community-based organizations, other government departments, make it practical and make it action-driven. So that when we come back, we know exactly what we are going to do because we've seen, we've heard, we now know where that money needs to be reallocated to.
Yeah.
And that's what we need to do. And then we forget the rural community. Rural women having no way of getting to a police station to go and report.
Yeah.
And they just live year on year with it. I work in the rural communities of Kanaland. That is my constituency. And every question I ask to ministers, president, it's always focused on the rural women, rural young people, because they are forgotten. They're not in small towns like that in the Karoo. People don't talk to each other. The police does not know that a perpetrator has been released, knowing that he's dangerous. He murders a 79-year-old woman, and after she's now killed and dead, we hear that he was never supposed to be out. No one was informed that he's out, and that is now what has happened.
And
that's,
I think,
real.
That's where the multi-departmental approach is required.
Yes.
Because in many instances, you've got departments working in silos and not working together because you need to have a synergy. And in all of that, whatever good is found in Claremont must be replicated in Mitchell's Plain and Nyanga East.
Yeah.
But you don't see it happening. And it's something that sometimes it boils my blood. Because
tell us more.
I would want to see communities being treated in the same way. Resources being deployed where they are needed the most. But at the moment, you don't see that. Yeah. You hardly see it. And in many instances, women who become victims of gender-based violence are women who are unemployed. Because their income or whatever it is, their economic activities are dependent on a man. And they choose to stay. There was this girl who once said to me, you know, Sis Pat, if my boyfriend doesn't beat me, I don't feel comfortable, and I provoke him.
I grew up, and that's what every woman
you
used
must
to say.
Be crazy. Because I would ditch that affair immediately. With one slap, I'm out.
So I work in the period poverty space, and people do not realize how aligned young women missing about 60 days of school per mm-hmm. year mm-hmm. because they can't afford sanitary products mm-hmm. actually is involved mm. in rape. It's involved in child trafficking, because if you are home and you are a child and you're in your nightie walking around, they either know they can rape you now mm. or could do it in 28 days mm. and come back. Mm. And people do not realize how this piece of cloth or piece of paper is literally them not having it is destroying young women's lives mm. continuously. Mm. And if she's not worth flipping 15 rand or whatever it is for the cheaper ones, if she's not worth that, how do you expect it to be worth anything when she's getting gang raped? Then everyone goes, oh, what a shock. And you're like, wait, but she wasn't worth just free sanitary pads. Uh-huh. Just free sanitary pads. And how connected it is.
Just as is it easy to have condoms in every free space.
Yeah.
We should be having sanitary towels in every space.
And condoms, together. We need free. Exactly. We need both. They shouldn't be either or.
I'm saying there seems to be a prioritization of condoms
yeah.
and not sanitary yes. towels. Mm.
There's another question. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's fine.
There's another question which ChatGPT gave me a good question here that I thought number 9 is really worth it. ChatGPT masterpiece. And I need to read it word for word. A year on from the formation of the Government of Unity, how do each of you see this new way of doing politics in South Africa? Should we as South Africans feel that our voices are being heard more with the GNU, with more parties represented? Thank you,
Did you say 1 year or 10 years?
It's been 1 year.
1 year.
1 year since GNU.
We've had Gaten for 1 year.
Sorry, I thought you were saying...
Too soon. Too soon. Okay. Relax, guys. Relax. I don't want him calling me names.
Like, what kind of podcast is this?
What do you think? How's politics been done since the GNU?
In the statement of intent of the GNU, there's a lot said about societal change and social justice. But when you really unpack that, what does that mean for the ordinary person in the street? Mm. And so a year on, we have said now, okay, we're going to improve and put more resources into Tuzela Centers, which is a center that offers a one-stop shop for...
Post-violence care.
Yes, like medical, psychosocial, all those things and all of that. It's happening, but it's not happening at the pace that it should, which means the intention is there, but it is not happening at the pace it should be happening. And the question is to me, why? There shouldn't be a why, because now we are all... not only one party, we are many parties. The problem is that politicians tend to fail to move beyond their political alignment. Mm. The political maturity that is needed is to say, my daughter, your daughter, all of them are exposed to the same risks and dangers out there. So if we collectively work on it, forget about the color of our T-shirt, and the per party that we stand for, we actually can do this in record time. And you know where all the work really happens, I feel, in Parliament and within the GNU, is in the committees. It's there where you can actually thrash out things. It's there where you find each other across political parties. It's on oversights that you find each other. Because in the bigger chamber, It's grandstanding. Mm. But in the committees, and that's where the power should be more and more authority should be given for us to take more decisions that will have an impact. And that is my sincere view.
Are you allowed to say everything you just said?
I am allowed, yes.
No jokes, I'm just saying. That wasn't a joke. But would they want to hear you say these things? Are you permitted to say these
things? I'm saying these things in committees. Okay. Because we are fairly, open and flexible when we are in committees. And it's all aired. I mean, my researcher is sitting here. He might just report me tomorrow. But it's just the open, honest truth. And I know many colleagues feel like this.
Okay. Are we angry enough as a country? Because when I go through X, Twitter, most people are saying we're not angry enough. Are we angry enough at the state of how women have been treated in this country and children?
What does it do to be angry?
I was about to say.
So now we're going
to
be angry. We march. Uyunene was how long ago? Mm. And I was there. We were all there. Mm. Like, we were all there. What's changed since then? Mm. So what does it actually do to be angry? Mm. Like, I think I'm beyond that. For me personally, I'm speaking for myself. Like, I'm beyond that. I'm like, I just want to see action from everybody. Mm. Like, I'm not necessarily holding a single individual or a group of people or an organization accountable, but every single person, like, what can we be doing in our spaces very practically on a day-to-day basis? Like, what can we be doing? What conversations do we need to be having? Being angry, even if you look at what's going on in the world, posting about it is not changing things. Mm-hmm. Like, it's bringing awareness, sure, but it's not changing anything. So, like, until I think we start having serious conversations with ourselves about, like, what responsibility should we be taking? What very practically can we be doing in our day-to-day lives to address things? We're not actually going to get anywhere. We can be as angry as we want on Flippin' X, and it's not going to change anything.
In fact, we only need action, and action with speed. Mm. There's no time to delay anything. There's no time to put a matter on the control for 2 years. A matter must be dealt with speed.
How do we make that go fast? That's what I'm asking. How do we make that go fast? How do we make them move?
I think our courts need to improve in that regard, because remember, a matter is only being brought to court when it has been investigated. It's only one or two cases where there would be outstanding queries. As far as GBV cases are concerned, there are prosecutors that are assigned to the child victim support unit. So those prosecutors are guiding the investigating officers to go and collect this. They even sometimes go out with you as an investigator to collect information that would be required. So courts needs to act with speed, considering if you have been following some of the extortion cases. The extortionists are released because witnesses are being eliminated. So we really need to act with speed so that we avoid any unnecessary delays.
But that's why we should have GBV specialized courts.
Agreed.
I believe strongly that is what we need. GBV specialized courts, harsher sentences, and trials much more shorter. You will see the difference that it will make.
Yeah. I do want to add something about accountability, because I do think that, I think, Rachel, you started talking about, like, how it's not one person we want to keep accountable. So you asked the question about the president. I think it needs to be at every level. Mm-hmm. So as an individual, how are you contributing to this problem? And what are you going to do to keep yourself accountable to it? As a local government, as a police officer on the other side of the desk, we need to ask more questions. And we also need to be able to understand what our rights are so that we are able to use it. And I think for organizations like Mosaic and others who are doing the work, we don't get tired, which is why I'm wearing color. I'm not depressed. I'm not sad. I'm not grieving, because I have to move. We have to work. We need to keep hopeful. Okay. And I also think it's very important to start thinking about, as we are doing these moves and as we're navigating the accountability and having the conversations at every level, we also need to ensure that we don't forget those who are actually at the coalface.
Yeah.
We are sitting here. While I'm sitting here, I have staff members who are just clocked in at the TCC. I have staff members that just clocked out of court. And in one day, they can see 25 different traumas. that's just one day, and that's besides the things that they bring themselves. At the TCC, we don't know who's going to come in with what level of injury, because to come to a TCC means you're coming to a hospital, which means that something had brought you to the hospital. I think that we also, I think you started mentioning the kind of lack of lived experience. Mm-hmm. Everyone who's sitting at national level, you are having discussions, and yes, everyone like has the prowess of we have great laws, and that's awesome. Implementation, seeing the lived experiences, knowing that in communities people have access to machine guns. What the heck? What is that? You know what I mean? There's no level of safety, not for any individual, and specifically not for those who are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So I do think that for me, while the conversations around accountability needs to happen, and just please don't get me wrong, I think it's important that we keep the engagement going.
Yeah.
But it's also important that we ensure that the things on the ground are happening and people are being responsive. And I would promise you that I believe that if people were to see that the systems work, if people see that they can go to SAPS and they can actually report and something will happen, or if they go to court and actually a case is being seen to, there's going to be some deterrence. I'm not saying that like everyone's going to change, but there's going to be like, I can't do this crime because someone is seeing me and someone's going to follow up and someone's listening, and I'm going to actually be like, I'm going to actually have to stand and be accountable for this crime. I think that's going to be the shift. So it is a conversation that needs to be ongoing, that prevention stuff needs to happen, but also we need institutions that's going to be very responsive and effective in the work that they do.
We're going to move into a couple of questions. I commend all four of you, because for me, you were able to word it in ways that I wish I could, because I'm fuming. Like I'm so upset, I'm so angry, and I want to be productive and angry at the same time. I can multitask. I really can. I really, really can. I cannot see a dead woman every other day on my Instagram every single day without being fuming and not wanting to knock doors down.
Yeah.
And that's the man side of me. It's problematic, but I'm just too furious to be able to put it into words. Comments and questions, please. Guys, you guys have been amazing. There's more questions to come your way.
Okay.
I'll start. The researcher, is she in trouble? I'm joking.
Good evening, everyone.
Is that on?
No.
Okay. Oh. It must be here.
Okay. Good evening, everyone. So just a few questions from my side.
A few questions? Only one?
No, so I only have 100, but I'll keep it to 3. So just to pick up, my memory is gone now, but let me just say that there needs to be a way how we shift from how do we investigate rape and how do we do counseling. Fortunately for me, as opposed to Eleanor, I get to be a bit more in the communities. And the first thing that happens when a woman is raped, the detectives come and they say, no, you can't interview her now. But for criminal purposes, the statement needs to be taken as soon as possible. And then the psychologist walks in, debrief starts, and sometimes in that process, women forget. And that's where defense lawyers take advantage of the gap and criminals themselves. I'll give you just a sad statistic I found out yesterday when I was speaking to one of my members on police, is that we only have 3 canine dogs that are in the Western Cape trained in fluid detection. 3. In the Western Cape.
Now that makes me angry.
To add to that, we only have 3 flying squad cars. 2 of them were diverted 2 weeks ago to the EFF rally, which means we had 1 car for the entire province. Then just to sticking on the policing issue, there's a study that I've been privy to that says that 60 to 70% of rural South Africans don't know how to define GBV. So how do you know you were raped? How do you know you were assaulted if you don't know how to define it? That's where, and I'm sure we know about GBV in Joburg. We know about GBV in Cape Town. But what about in rural Northern Cape? What about in rural KZN, where it's seen as, no, it's normal. It happened to my mother, my grandmother, so it happened to me, so now there's nothing abnormal about it. In fact, we've normalized abnormal in South Africa. But then my last question, and I happened to get this question from someone who's right now working as part of the G20 group on women, And she says, Sean, I want to ask you this question. I didn't answer. But she says, South Africa does quite well when it comes to putting women in positions of power. We do a bit better in government departments, but we do okay in private sector. But we far, in fact, we're on par with, we even lead some developed countries. Should we not be questioning why women in those positions are not advocating more? And another thing, just wrapping up, I remember leaving...
You're doing your own podcast now, but...
I was wrapping up my master's study, and I remember leaving campus one day and running into a very well-known deputy minister we all know. I won't say the name, I'll just call person X. I'm a man of budgets and statistics. I look at because statistics and science doesn't lie, people do. And I asked the minister, do you know when I looked at your budget, you give 11 rand to every GBV shelter? And she was like, really? I didn't know that. And you give 350 rand a day to a prisoner. So if that doesn't tell you where our priorities lie, I don't know what will. Thank you.
Okay, so that's why he's your researcher. That's why he's your researcher. So he said a lot that should make us angrier and then implement. What can we do to change those particular things that actually just, I've got a Twitter rant ready and an Instagram rant ready right now. How can we help that? Like, come on.
My first thing would be like the Minister of Finance and the finance people are not in the room with us. You know, so we want to talk about 11 Rand. The reality is that we run two shelters. We don't run it on the 11 Rand, by the way. We do ensure that there's like a good space for women and their children, and we don't separate their children from them. But I also think that, again, for me, this is like the conversation about patriarchy. Like, so there are so many women represented in Parliament. Why are they not talking for everyone else? Cool. It's their responsibility. This is where you should be an ally. And so how do we shift the conversation to why are we not doing enough for the women in South Africa? And it needs to be a collective conversation and not just the number of women that are in Parliament. I think that's quite unfair to expect.
Okay. Positions. I also just wanted to touch on the rural communities. I know many nonprofits that are working so much in rural communities with very little support, very little resource. And if they had more and less red tape, because unfortunately in rural communities as well, the red tape to get stuff done and infrastructure and to be able to work is insane. To do boreholes, it's crazy. And so if, again, there was more of a collaboration happening between government and the nonprofit sector, and there was more funds being funneled into these organizations that I might add, do tons of research, tons of data collections, tons of statistic and information. They've got so much information. And with more money, they're able to do more work. But unfortunately, it's just not getting to the nonprofits. And so that would be my point on the rural communities.
So in fact, we do little to fund civil society structures that are out there doing the very same work. I've crisscrossed the Western Cape. And there seems to be one common name of an NGO that renders this type of support in the rural areas. And that makes you wonder what works for Piet Sonner Water should be working also in the Karoo. But this organization have sister parties that they would appoint to render the same support, whereas the money goes to this bigger organization. And it doesn't distribute money in according to what should be done. Because indeed, in the rural areas, there's little attention that is being paid. And therefore, if there's little attention, those NGOs are supposed to be educating government, civil society, communities. There shouldn't be a gap. But because of the manner in which we're working, there seems to be a huge gap such that people do not understand or they don't even know if they are exposed to violence. So there's a lot that needs to be done because there is no correlation.
Yeah.
if government stop monopolizing funding NGOs, we could go a great deal.
Yeah.
But at the moment, certain NGOs are being funded, others are not. You know, it's so painful to sit in a committee where a female says, I lodged a complaint against my director and I've been told to stay and work from home. Or I have been moved from my department and placed in another department while the perpetrator has been left untouched. Yeah. Patriarchy plays a major role.
Massive.
It plays a major role within government departments. I've had two cases that I would raise continuously, but nothing is being done because a person is perceived to be innocent until proven guilty, while a woman suffers at the end of the day.
I just want to quick bite.
As long as you want.
The advocating part of women parliamentarians for me is something that I think is crucial. And I think many a times, as parliamentarians, we somehow are limited because of policies that is either within your party or policies that is or legislation that's within parliament. The system in parliament, I believe, does not allow or give us enough opportunity to advocate, and so. Personally, for me, I found a way around it. Mine is to, when I'm in my constituency, I don't go meet the municipal manager and the city manager and whoever councillors. I walk around. So when I get into my constituency, the lady at the petrol station knows me. She talks to me. I know her name. I know what she wants to do other than she wants to work there. I could go to the local store. I would know. So I do my work and I spend like a week. For instance, 2 weeks, next week I will go there. And I engage with them. And that's how I believe I'm playing my role in advocating. I make women aware that this is, if you are getting beaten up tonight, this is what you can do. And if you don't have data, if you don't have airtime, this is what you can do. And someone will come out and help you and reach you. I get up and at night when I get called. I phone someone because when I stay in my constituency, I don't stay in a hotel or in a B&B. I stay in a house in the neighborhood with someone that I know happened to study with. But I see what happens in that neighborhood. So I live, I hear. And so they don't see me as someone sitting there. They see me as, oh, Eleanor's here. She's part of us. And whenever I leave, whatever I've seen, I put that into questions, written or oral, to ministers, which are then obliged, they must respond to me. And I can then go back to that community and say, you've raised this issue. This is what's going to happen, and we will follow on it. And if it's not the required responses that we are getting or actions, there's further things that you can do. Whether it's a protest, whether it is a interview on radio, whatever. But yeah.
So a woman who teaches me a lot every day, usually I call her to rant about things that make me angry and when I'm trying to save the world, and she usually puts me in my place. Karen has a couple of words to say.
Hi. Well, firstly, thank you so much to the panel. Deep respect for all of you. I have, I think, 2 points. Firstly, can I comment on the pressure I feel like you're putting on women who are in high-powered positions in the corporate space? I don't think it's up to those women to change society. The fact that they've worked as hard as they have to get to that space is testament enough for how much they've advocated for themselves and women. The one thing I would say to them is give a hand up to other women and don't step on them. But we don't see what happens in boardrooms and what those women have to do to overcome mansplaining and everything else just to keep in that space. Yeah. So I just want to put that out there. And it's not a criticism. It's more just a big up to those women for being in those space. I have two questions. One to the parliament or to the politicians and one to Rachel and Ronelle. So to the politicians, just last week, there was a answer from Parliament, from the President himself. There was a question put to him by, I think it was a Build One South Africa MP, put a question to him around how many of Cabinet members have been vetted against the National Register of Sex Offenders and the Child Abuse Register. The President came back and said, we do not fall into the category that needs to be vetted. And therefore, it is not a requirement. So I'm not going to ask you to speak on behalf of the President because that would be unfair. What I am going to ask is your party. So we've got two parties represented here. What is your policy to vet people in public leadership? So that will be my question, because I think that goes a long way for accountability. Okay. Then to Rachel and Ronel, I've always believed that we already have the answers to actually end food poverty, to end period poverty, to end violence and gender-based violence. It exists within the very communities that that violence is happening, and whichever community that is. Do you think that more needs to be done to learn from local solutions rather than bringing in international consultants to design programs that are then supposed to be blanketly implemented across communities that are so diverse? Those would be my two questions.
That's why I call her. That's why that's my first call when something is here and I'm like here. Great questions, great comments.
Okay, so I think from the Democratic Alliance side, and I personally have gone through, rigorous, grueling assessments and evaluations before I could become a public representative. And so you really get vetted and grilled. You have to, there's a process that starts with you just having to declare whether you have any criminal record or not. That then gets checked whether you have or not. You are then assessed based on your work in community. That gets verified whether what you are saying on paper is indeed so. You write tests, but everything. So when, say for instance now, for the elections next year, the process has already started. You have maybe applied, but you already fell out because the first process of vetting has chucked you out because something was found or something, and you can't go through to the next. So I'm fortunate, and I always say that very proudly, that I'm in a party that ensures that whoever goes out and represents the public has been through a process. It's not about whether you are popular or not. You can be the smartest person, and you could probably, but if it's found, we deal with it. And we're not saying that some of them are not going through the cracks. Maybe. We don't know. Sometimes people manipulate systems. I don't think in our case we can. We have refined our system even now so that you, throughout your term of 5 years, you are being evaluated and assessed. So that if something is found midterm, it's been dealt with already and not in 5 years' time only. We realize, but Eleanor has actually been this and that. So, yeah, that is what I can say. I'm quite comfortable with the system that we have.
But okay, and I have to say this, but many politicians come into politics with no criminal records and then get criminal records while they're politicians and stay as politicians with criminal records. Now, Sisi, you're from the ANC, and I have to admit that there are many people in the ANC who become criminals and stay as politicians. How are we going to fix that?
It's like a leading question.
If I went home from here for not asking that question, I'd be very upset with myself.
No, the question is really a good one. But I want to start by saying, since I've been in the legislature since 2014, I've had to go and get a criminal record, which I would submit to the list committee. And as and when one has a criminal record, you would be told to withdraw. A nice example would have been the 2024 general elections. In the Western Cape, there was one person who was removed from the list because of a criminal record.
Then how did dating get passed? And I'm so sorry. I'm not being petty. I'm not being petty. That's a question.
And
that's a true question, guys. I'm sorry. How did Gayton get to where he is? Mm. He's got a criminal record. I'm just trying to just...
I'll explain.
Okay? No jokes?
There's a process called expungement. There's a process called expungement. If one has been sentenced, serve your sentence, and after a certain period, you apply to the President of the Republic to expunge. But it also depends on the severity of the offense that you would have committed. So, if you have killed somebody or you have been involved in an armed robbery, those classifications, those do not qualify for one to have a case expunged. So one may be, for instance, if I may have been involved in a culpable homicide, my criminal record can be expunged because I was not charged for murder. There's a distinction between murder and culpable homicide. It may have been that I was not found to have been responsible directly. Maybe a collision.
Okay.
A collision, one can be charged and be sentenced for culpable homicide. And sometimes, in many instances, if you've been charged for culpable homicide, you would either be paying a fine or serve a minor sentence. So that's where the process of expungement come into play. So I can safely say, in the Western Cape, I know of one example of a person that has been removed from the list because of a record. And in the ANC, there's a process that is called step aside. When you have been found to have been irresponsible or been actively informed in something, you are then asked to step aside.
But you don't.
Until a matter has been resolved in court, whether you've been found guilty or not. However, there's a lot of discussions that has been taking place as to, can we unpack step aside? What happens to step aside? Can you really get paid whilst you are at home?
No.
Because there has to be what we call your value for money. Mm-hmm. A value for money has to apply. So there has been discussion. It's a new process that has been introduced, in the 2022 National Conference. So we are going to refine it. We have another conference in 2027. We are going to refine it.
But on this topic, so if you have a couple homicide case, right, mm-hmm. you can get it squashed. But if you book a trip without his consent, you will lose your job.
Yep.
How does that make sense?
Exactly.
I'm not siding with the DA, but he booked the trip illegally, right? Semantics. He booked the trip without the president's consent, right? And then he got dropped from his job. But if you were up for couple homicide or armed robbery, they kind of sponge your case. But not if you booked a trip without his consent.
Expungement is as a result of a court process.
Okay.
It is as a result of a court process.
You've got a lot to say.
It's not just a process that comes from a tribunal or from a kangaroo court.
It's
a court outcome that has to be expunged.
Okay. But that's still a bit kangaroo-ish.
Yeah, that's true. You want to say something? I can hear your DA voice. I can hear it here.
No.
I can hear it here.
I'm just saying, we know the Zondo Commission. We know what people have done. Mm-hmm. They're sitting today still as ministers. It has come out. More things have come out on certain ministers. They are still there. So what my colleague is saying here is not happening. What she's saying is what is an ideal.
What does the Zondo Commission have to do with someone being convicted?
Someone must be convicted. There are people.
Then the expungement comes into play.
There are people that's sitting there that... every day. I mean, last week.
Actually, I want to jump. Diego, okay, I'm going to jump there. DA, you guys put someone into your parliament who had used the K word in a video, and that went through the cracks. But he snuck through the cracks too, eh?
No, he's gone.
He's gone, but he snuck through.
No, exactly. but he's gone.
Exactly.
But immediately we dealt with him.
Agreed. But the squashing.
Look, it's very nice to point a finger from one person to another. In the provincial legislature, we had the former speaker who was found guilty in a code of conduct committee to have spent taxpayers' money by driving a second vehicle, whereas there was a vehicle allocated to that person. And there were delay tactics, taking the decision of the conduct committee on review, and whereas there's a decision that says this person must pay back the money, it was not only the deputy speaker, but also the former secretary to the legislature. Both of them must pay the money. And what happened? Taking it on review, bringing in private lawyers, and at the end of the day, the term comes to an end. That person has not been processed through.
But is it gone now?
She's gone, but she still owes. There was a decision by the conduct committee that she must pay back the money.
Okay, so, okay, wait.
But we're off the topic.
We've got to stay to the club topic.
Yes.
There's two more questions, and then we got to go. Yes, you may, ma'am.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Samantha LaRue. I'm the founder of a non-profit organization called Cornerstone Woman, recently rebranded Family. Okay. I'm not going to say that I have a question, but I would like to leave the podcast party and the audience, who I highly respect, with something to think about. We've been in existence since 2016, 9 years. We are not dealing with a gender and domestic problem. We are dealing with a human behavior problem. Please listen to me. It would be unlike my character and nature for me to leave tonight without taking this opportunity. Ladies, if there are so many monsters, I'm going to ask you who's raising them. I'm raising two kings and a queen. My sons are not monsters. We no longer can demonize men. I've had over 500 people come through my organization. I've self-funded the majority of what we supply, whether it's emotional and behavior support, providing somewhere to sleep, school, fees, food. And I'm standing now as a woman, a mother of three children. And I'm saying this conversation, Rachel, you were absolutely correct. We have had too many times. Ladies, we have the ability to stand up and stand next to men, but we definitely cannot stand over them. As a mother, I am raising two kings. There will be no abuse from my sons. Everything starts at home. It is not the responsibility of government. It is not the responsibility of anyone. But the mother. And I'm going to tell you why I say that. Because we're giving far too much power away. When we know things are wrong, we know we should leave. But we stay. For financial reasons. Because we, too uncomfortable to go get a job? Ladies, this is a debate we can have to length. I have 9 years' experience in this space and over 500 people. My point is, I am not separating us. I'm putting us on the same platform. And I'm saying if we don't come together to change, we will never solve this problem. My sons are not demons. They are kings. But it starts at home. It's the behavior that they witness. Not what I tell them to do, but what I show them. And that is very important. I know it's a very hard conversation. Far too long that we've allowed women to hold a victim card as a get-out-of-jail card. This is life, not Monopoly. And I'm not saying that we do not experience terrible atrocities, but so do men. If you really want change, let's stop fighting and let's stand together. hold women as accountable as we are holding men for behaviors.
I'm sorry, I can't actually.
Okay, wait.
No.
Okay.
Sorry,
no,
Rachel,
but
it's true.
I'm going to agree with that. If she knows that, my struggles, no.
We need another hour, but I would like.
However, thank you very much. I would like
each one of you to address what she said, but please not too long. But let's go in.
I'm not addressing it. No. It's nonsense. No.
It's nonsense that men don't have a platform.
Please can that microphone be taken away because this is actually...
Why? Because you have a social standing?
Be careful. Be careful.
No, sorry, Rachel. With all due respect, I've been doing this for 9 years. I've funded it on my own.
And I've seen
as many men be demonized, have been manipulated, been hurt by women. They have been treated... I'm sorry. And you know what? With good conscience, I cannot stand up and go, it's a gender problem or a domestic problem. It's a human behavior problem. And women are manipulating situations. They manipulate the courts. They manipulate all sorts.
No, let her finish.
Everybody's entitled to a voice. And I think since I've stood in an organization that I've literally funded myself for 9 years... I can stand here saying, this is not a fight against men.
No, this is
about us saying, come together.
We never said it's a fight against
Come together.
I don't think anyone has said.
But it's not nonsense, Rachel. I challenge you on that.
Okay, wait. This is definitely something I need you guys to add your views on. Please, can you give me a... Not too long.
I must say, it has never been a fight against men.
Okay, well...
I think that is what I have said. It was a fight against men. If you could just recall what I was saying, we need to work on getting men to be more vulnerable, more emotional, in touch with their emotional intelligence. And I'm taking it from my own lived experiences as a divorced woman who is raising 3 kings, 2 kings and 1 queen alone. And I don't want to get into... And I'm not making their dad my enemy. I'm trying to work with him.
Wait.
So we are taking responsibility. Yes, if they are, that's so. I am not like Rachel. I will not get involved in this conversation. It is for me too close to home, and I don't agree, really.
Okay. I think maybe just like a quick conversation for me is that there's so much learning, unlearning, and relearning that we need to do as a society. I think that, this is not to agree with you.
I don't think
But I do think it's important that we also think and find a place to constructively engage, because as an organization, as a practitioner, we get to all men all the time, or not all men, or not all women. 21% of our services is actually rendered to men who are survivors. But I'm not here to talk about men, because disproportionately it is women and children, persons with disabilities. I mean, the list can go on, and we've got data to prove it. You have 9 years. I've got 3 years in the sector. But our organization has 32 years. And it's quite a bittersweet moment for us to even be sitting here. Because if in 30 years of a democracy, we've not been able to figure it out, there's something wrong. There's a problem. And I think that we need to stop trying to choose sides and actually, again, I'm not trying to agree with you, but I do think it's important to say that as we are standing in our different corners, we are not actually getting to a place where we're actually discussing how do we move forward. Because, and I think, Sia, it's so important to say that this is supposed to be constructive. We're supposed to be thinking about how do we actually build solutions to a South Africa that we all want to live in a place where all of us can be safe. I think the one thing that I hold close is that my perspective of GBV had shifted many different times. And the biggest moment for me was when I became a mother. But another big moment was when I became a practitioner, because I think there's something so different about when you're sitting on your couch and you're like watching things happen, whether you're scrolling on X or whatever it is that you do, and you actually be confronted with what's happening, the scourge, what did the president call it? The second pandemic. We don't have COVID anymore. Has it moved to first? you know, and you have the questions, the right questions. We have to critically engage. We have to say, you know, this is what the data is telling us and this is how we want to move forward. But we also need to recognize that our opinions is not obsolete or absolute. Sorry, English.
I'm still quite impressed by how you all stay so calm and still were able to put things into words. I'm impressed by all four of you.
It's yay, in the space.
It's only in parliament where we become emotional.
Humans
are fighting.
This is why I think.
We're not fighting.
Like, what is beautiful is that it's a moment that's had. People can have two different views. But you guys were able to go into this calm place that I think many of us men need to learn to be able to go to.
That's why there should be more women in leadership positions.
Agreed. I think we should work together. Agreed. I think we should work together as men and women. Agreed. Okay, one last question.
I wanted to say something.
Okay, one, two, then we must go because it got action-packed. Now it's going to... Okay, I've got two. I'm going to one, two, and then we're going to call it quits. Before I come to you, sir.
No, thank you. I think we've come to realize that the victims of GBV have a gender. Uyinene had a gender. She was a female. Lolita from Makaza in Khayelitsha had a gender. She was a female. And the question is, who are the perpetrators? The perpetrators are men. But here today, we're not saying we must not hold a boy child by the hand. We're saying resources being available must be made in ensuring that we rear and protect boys from becoming whatever that these men who are killing Uyinene Lolita are. I would say becoming animals, but we don't rear a man or a human being to be an animal.
Yes.
All we're saying, we must hold a boy child. We must have program for a boy child to raise them to be people, to raise them to understand and be kind to one another. Agreed. That's what I always say to my son. He's 14, turning 14 in December. Yes. I always say, Muitumelo, be kind at all times.
If you're watching the podcast and you didn't realize, but the mother of the two kings has left. So we hope her two kings can live in a room with people who have different inputs to hers, can actually handle. So let's hope that she's taught her two kings that small lesson in society. We have a gentleman over there.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to comment on your first opening statement, which is the why. And just from a man's perspective, like the why is we live in a country with a lot of anger, huge mental health crisis we've got going on. I think a really missing piece to this arsenal of what we have to stop gender-based violence is mental health. And how can we focus on men now who are struggling with emotional deregulation? And men don't want to be that way.
Yes.
You know, we can't only focus on boys. The result of that is only 30 years from now.
Yes.
So we need more resources for mental health. A lot more psychologists in the country, a lot more therapists. These are all preventative tools for men now.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah. So I have thank you so much for that comment. I have many guy friends and who have been like tried to commit suicide. One of them tried four times last year. Mental health issues, struggling with many things. They feel like they're in a void, that no one's listening to them. I know it sounds like we're making excuses, but my guy friends are struggling, and I'm talking about ones who are late 30s, who are not married, have no kids, are really, really struggling. And we cannot, I'm not agreeing with her, but men are in trouble. And when women are in trouble, they hurt themselves, but when men are in trouble, they hurt other people. And it's evident in... I think there's multiple things. I think a lot of them feel like they need to provide, and they're struggling to provide for their families or for the people in their world. protecting. They're not really needed to protect. There's electric fences, there's gates, there's, you know. I think it's value. I think they feel unvalued. If you look at the stats about men in universities, there's 60% of the people in universities are women. Suicide has increased, mental health, and I think a lot of them believe or see equality as a pie, and just because women have equality, that is a piece of a pie, and that's not how equality works. But men are in trouble. We cannot deny men are in trouble. It's undeniable that men are in trouble and struggling. But I don't think that's exactly what she was saying. I need to wrap it up. There's a lady at the back over there. Sorry.
Good evening, everyone. So I am a linguist, and we are usually trained to look at society and language and how language affects things that are happening in society, right? I'm not a forensic linguist, but I have a colleague who is, and I'm exposed to a lot of her work. And the gentleman over there mentioned something very important, that in Cape Town and Joburg, we know how to define a lot of issues. And I think a lot of the panel also touched on the language issue without really mentioning it. It's always on the periphery. But English, if you didn't know, English is the only language of record in South Africa, in a courtroom, in a police station. So what that means is that in a country that's multicultural, multilingual, where the majority of people are not English speakers or first language English speakers, when they go to report a crime, whether it be a GBV crime or any other crime, they have to try to do it in English. And if they're unable to do that, then it's on the police officer taking the statement to do that, and it's for the victim to sign that statement, and that's what is used in the courtroom whenever the court proceedings happen, which is, I think, could be another issue that adds to, you know, things being reported incorrectly or inaccurately, but that's just what we have to go with. You know, a lot of the time you can't backtrack statements or fix things after you hear it being read to you in the courtroom. So it's just a comment, but I think that it's a very big issue in our country.
That is an absolutely incredible question that I've never ever thought of as a second language English speaker. That is an incredible comment. Guys, we have to close it off now. I'd like one comment from each person. I think this episode is going to be action-packed, and I hope many of you have learned a lot, even with the people who disagreed and people that, you know, when we veered this way. I think this is a complex issue that can't be answered in such a short time. Can we start with last comments from each of you? First of all, before you say anything, I am inspired more than ever to get involved. Wherever you need me, all of you, please let me know where I can be to be able to take my anger and put it into the right direction. I'm really inspired by all the work that you do, and you guys are, hey, I've learned a lot today, so thank you so much.
I just want to say that building and working on building positive masculinity is not to diminish men's identities. It is actually to encourage men to become their authentic selves. And I think if we work together and we work on the approaches and societal attitudes and norms collectively, we could actually all be in a community or society where we can actually deal with this. And for the men in the room, thank you. When you speak about, you know, the rugby matches and the what, also bring in those conversations that are coming not so easy. Talk to each other, encourage each other, because it's needed. You don't talk enough like we do. We want you to do that. Thank you very much.
Rachel, please.
Oh, you know what? I'm actually just struggling so much because I was actually so triggered by that comment. And I think that anyone watching this podcast very possibly will be as well. So I actually think there needs to be a trigger warning, because it's actually like I'm all for everybody having their opinion and freedom of speech. But to hear a woman so diminished and so unconsidered is just wild to me that in 2025... we still sit in a room and someone feels, you know, okay to stand up and say such things about women. And I also just want to highlight that I think a lot of really phenomenal solutions have been brought to the table tonight, and that should not overshadow the fact that there were some really practical, really important points raised tonight. And I think that those in some way, shape, or form could and should be implemented. And I also just want to raise the fact that when we first opened for questions, the only hands actually that I had first seen were men. And also just to highlight the fact that I love that. I think it's so great that there are three men in the audience, but not many, but that they are the ones putting up their hand to be a part of the conversation. Yeah. And sometimes I think it's intimidating, right? It's intimidating being in a room with powerful women and to put up your hand and to make a point or ask a question that might not be correct or, you know, interpreted a certain way. But I think that it's great that men are putting up their hand to be a part of the conversation and just keep putting up your hand.
I wasn't ready for that, but I think that one of the big lessons that we've kind of taken away from our work is that we can't do it by ourselves, not as NGOs, not as government. Like, we need to be able to work together, and so it's finding ways to find spaces where we can do that, find ways in which we are able to collaborate with government, with other NGOs in the sector. Some need to be vetted, but we need to find ways.
Depends on the crime.
Depends
on the crime.
But I also think that there's like so much value in being able to learn from one another. And I do want to draw on the question that Karen had asked and we weren't able to reply to. But just to say that it's not easy to also be in a position, because you said about like the vulnerability of men raising their hands. There's also a lot of intimidation, you know, from an organization that has been around for 30 years. Most people look at us like we have all the answers, and we don't. You know, part of like how we are moving forward is also to engage with local spaces. And actually, we have all of our staff also be from local communities where we work, because the people who know are the people who have the lived experience. But we need to find ways to draw them in more meaningful ways and not wait until a researcher comes and writes it all up. Mm-hmm. And now it's perfect and everyone, like, you know, quotes the researcher. But actually to, like, instill that we are our own writers, and how do we narrate this, like, world that we want to experience, and how do we want to see a safe South Africa? Because I can imagine it, but I don't know what it will feel like.
Well, GBV is not a women's struggle. It is actually a national struggle. And if we do not declare GBV as a pandemic, then we'd be missing a point. So I want to start there. But also I want to say that there's been so many talks, there's been so many summits. They are not yielding the results that we would want. So it's about time that we act, and when we act with speed. But as I say, I want to say that every man, every government department, all the three spheres of governance, civil society, and the communities, private sector, we must all work together in ensuring that we live in a society that is free.
This has been an incredible talk. I will get all your contacts. I think more needs to be done, more conversations. That question with the linguist was incredible. That comment is just, I think, a huge South African problem about language.
Yeah.
The mental health one as well, very important. I think we need to talk about this more. And thank you so much. There's this thing online with this, I always say it, with the purple background. What is it? And they always post woman, dead woman, every single day.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a part of me that goes to check it every day to see if there isn't a friend of mine or a woman that I know. And that's not normal. When I travel overseas, I have a best friend who's a female. And she, great song. let me just cut back so when they cut it, they can get it perfectly. I have this beautiful, beautiful friend of mine who is Nombagamiso, who's my best friend, and we travel the world together. And every time we travel the world together, I'm always just a step behind her in everything that we do. Because if you're a man, you always let your woman walk in front of you so you can look for danger.
Protect them.
And protect her. You do it instantly. You don't even know that you're doing it. I look forward to living in a world where I can just walk in front of her and look back and go, hurry up, man, tack! Hurry up, tack, tack! but I can't. And I always have to be one step behind her everywhere I go. And in some countries, I think I'm a little bit next to her because I feel like she's safer. Okay. And may I live in a country that I can just walk ahead of my best female friend and not worry that she will be on that purple background. And I thank you all for being here. I look forward to more conversations. And yeah, man, this was, I don't know if it made me angrier, but it made me angrier and made me feel like there's more solutions. So I will be quoting all of you like it's my comment. I'm for that one. So thank you so much to the podcast party. Thank you so much to all the ladies. Thank you so much for all the incredible work that you're doing. See you guys in the next conversation. Goodbye.